Hello, and welcome to the Classicist podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the Classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Morton and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to turn today to a piece that you recently wrote for National Review entitled "The Israel-U.S. Model Has Been a Resounding Success." Now, based on that title, listeners might think here that we're talking about the relationship between the countries as a model, but the argument actually here is that their respective approaches to domestic problems actually mirror each other more than is sometimes appreciated. So I'll have you take us through some of the similarities today. And the first one you point to, and here Israel is further down the road than us, but it's the idea that border walls really work. So take us through what the Israeli experience there has been like and what it might portend for the Trump administration's efforts to do something similar stateside.
Well, you remember during the various intifadas, 2001 to 2002-03, we were told that Israel couldn't stop it, that they had to basically appease the radical Palestinian, or all Palestinian. And then Sharon decided to start this wall, I think it was 400 miles, and make a concrete structure and physically separate themselves, mostly along the Green Line, but there's some areas where they take in parts of Jerusalem and others that are being adjudicated. They've offered compensatory territory, but for now, there's some areas, small areas of the West Bank, but basically they have a border wall, and it stops suicide bombings by 98%. And, I mean, they've tried everything, they being Israel's enemies, from drones to scaling the walls to tunneling them on. But basically, the principle remains as it always has throughout history. Walls don't keep all enemies out, but what walls do is they free up manpower to be used more economically. So that means the Israelis can invest more. If they're not always scrambling into the West Bank or patrolling nonstop the wall, they can use surveillance underground, above ground, and it's been very successful. And it also shows, it has political clarity. It tells the Palestinians, you do want to come into our country. If you just want to live and let live, just stay on your side of the wall. But for some reason, you all want to come into Israel, and very few of us, you know, want to go into Palestine other than these settlements. So we're creating little Israels on the West Bank. So the same thing by analogy is, I think, our own border wall, where Trump is saying, I know Mexico doesn't like us and Latin America calls us gringos and imperialists and neocolonials, but you all want to come into our country, and you want to come in our country so much you're willing to do it illegally, and we're not going to put it up with anymore. And it will work when we have walls like that are good, not just slipshod. It reduces the entrance rate radically. We know that from the San Diego wall, which isn't all that great. And then, more importantly, it frees up personnel to patrol and to deport and to do what they're supposed to do, rather than just, you know, go back and forth. So it also sends a message, a political message, a spiritual, philosophical, psychological message, that we are building a wall, and it's sort of like Berlin Wall in reverse. The left said it's a Berlin Wall, but they were half right. The Berlin Wall kept people in, not out, but more importantly, the Berlin Wall clarified that everybody wanted to get out of East Berlin and they wanted to go to West Berlin. And this wall keeps people out, but it does clarify the idea that whatever Mexico says about us or Latin America, they do want to come in here. And the reason they want to come in here is not because Mexico doesn't have natural resources or Central America doesn't have, it's because they're not constitutional, they're not consensual, they don't have independent judiciaries, they don't have transparencies, they do not allow racial and religious diversity in the same manner we do, they're not free market, they don't respect private property, they have problems with the equality of women, and when you put all of that matrix together, it means that people just don't want to live there. And that's what walls do. They kind of reify what we all suspect but don't dare voice.
The second point that you reference in the piece is energy policy. The U.S. and Israel both made big strides there. It's often kind of underappreciated outside of specialists. And this has an economic dimension, but it also has very significant foreign policy ramifications. So explain what has changed in both countries from a decade or two ago.
Well, both countries are immune from this Western disease of utopianism that has infected Western Europe and to some degree affected the Obama administration. That is, forbidding horizontal drilling or fracking, which redefine a country's oil and natural gas reserves. Obama, remember, didn't open up Anwar. He's tried to stop the Keystone Pipeline. He stopped all new federal leases of natural gas on federal territory, even though private frackers, where they could, increase U.S. production. And Trump, under Trump, in the last 3 years, we're going up 1 million barrels a day. I mean, excuse me, a year in added production. So what I'm getting at, and the same is true with Israel, with these huge offshore findings, and even some onshore they're starting to see. By that, I mean, Israel doesn't feel that politically and economically it has the margin of error not to develop these. It's aware that the environmental consequences, perhaps, if there is any, that's a largely debatable point. But more importantly, for the here and now, Israel is saying, for our existential survival, we are going to not have to depend on foreign sources of energy, especially from the Arab or Iranian or Islamic world. And more importantly, we understand that Western prejudice and bias toward us is not principled, because if it was, people would examine our democracy vis-a-vis the alternative, and they don't. And so why are they so anti-Israeli? Because of oil. That's because they import 30% of their oil. And they're, as I said earlier, they're the largest importer of oil in the world. So if we can at least export natural gas to Europe, and we can be of some service economically to Europe, maybe they'll readjust their political stance toward us. And there's some indication that in Britain, and maybe to a lesser degree in some of the Western European countries, and especially the Eastern Europeans, that's resonating. There seems to be a new axis among Cyprus, Greece, which I lived in 3 years, and I thought was one of the more anti-Israeli countries. But now Israel is in the orbit of Greece and Cyprus. And I think that's because it's considered that it has oil reserves like Cyprus and maybe Greece, and it has a common enemy in Turkey. There's one other thing, and I think it's really important, and that Trump hit upon with the same type of oil and border defense, and that is a country that's not arrogant, but oblivious to petty criticism, or does not neurotic, or does not want to be liked, but projects an idea that it has a sound economy, it has a strong military, it has a few good friends, and it's better to be a friend than an enemy of that country. That stance attracts people to it, and that's contrary to the modern therapeutic view that you have to be apologetic, you have to be constantly self-introspective, you have to understand your, some of that's valuable, but it creates a sense of weakness or neediness or vulnerability or victimhood. And most people, while they privately, while they publicly sort of show some sympathy, privately they don't want anything to do with it. That was the one good thing, not good thing, but maybe the one accurate thing that bin Laden, even though he was inaccurate in his appraisal, when he said people are attracted to the strong horse. His horse was weak, but he at least understood that people in the Thucydidean sense are no damn good. Whether we like it or not, they want to be, when the 49ers are 10-3, they have a full stadium. And when they're 3-10, they have nobody at the stadium.
There's a passing reference in your piece that I'd like to spend a little more time on here. You write in there, this is the quote, "The promoters of these unconventional policies, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Donald Trump, are both despised by their respective establishments and under constant threat of removal by their livid political opponents," close quote. Now, on a profile level, Trump and Netanyahu may seem somewhat contrasting figures, if for no other reason than Trump came into politics almost as a postscript to his career, and Netanyahu has been a major figure in Israeli politics for a very long time. They can be pretty different tonally, too, although there's a certain boldness they have in common. So my question is for you, Victor. How far can we take this comparison? And also, are there things that each of them perhaps could learn from the other?
Yeah, I think you have a good point that the similarity is in their boldness. They both not only are not too interested in what their critics say, but they're almost interested in aggravating their critics. So if their critics attack them, then they attack disproportionately, and they feel that that creates sort of political deterrence. They also have a brand name, the Netanyahu, because of the older brother who was killed on the Entebbe raid, Yossi, and the father who was one of the great historians of the Spanish Inquisition, and Ido, the brother who's a playwright. All of the Netanyahus were well known, and they had sort of a Trump-like name identification. I think that's similar as well. And then they're also a little bit mavericks within their own party. Netanyahu's conservative party was conservative in the European sense, at least economically. I mean, he was the first Israeli politician really to question the kibbutz system, socialism, EU-type economic policies, and go more toward a free market. And the way that Trump, maybe in contrast, but nevertheless was a maverick in Republican Party. He said, you know, we have free market economics, creative destruction, all that, but let's worry about assembly jobs and manufacturing jobs and a hollowed out interior, and let's get trade to be fair rather than just free. So there's a lot of similarities, and they're both, of course, hated by the left-wing press, and they're both Netanyahu is facing something equivalent to our notion of impeachment, that Trump's been impeached and is currently on trial in the Senate.
So the final question that I'll put to you, we've been talking about the U.S. and Israel on parallel tracks thus far. So I'd like to wrap up by talking about where, at the moment, they intersect. So we recently had the Trump administration roll out its long-promised Middle East peace plan with Prime Minister Netanyahu in attendance, which includes, amongst other things, a route potentially to Palestinian statehood. And Victor, whether you want to call them realists or cynics, there is a chunk of hard-bitten foreign policy types who roll their eyes every time a president starts talking about visions for peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And their argument is generally, if I can sort of crudely caricature it, that absent some major change in circumstances, you shouldn't expect some major change in outcomes. Is that appropriately pessimistic in this case, or is there reason to think that things could be different this time?
Well, you're absolutely true that that's the diagnosis that infects every presidency right before they go out of office, where it's Bush, as you remember, in 2008, or it was Obama in 2015. They all think that they have the magic brilliance or wisdom or caring to solve this problem. But the difference this time, as I said earlier, is that the United States doesn't need the Middle East. So if a Saudi prince says, we want something in this Palestinian deal, you better be careful about oil, we say, who cares? We don't need your oil. Or if somebody says, you better worry about an ISIS operative or Al-Qaeda operative, Trump will say, well, we don't really care. We'll bomb the blank blank like we did ISIS, or we'll kill Soleimani. We don't really care anymore. And so that's new, that the United States not only has strategic and economic alternatives, but it's redefined the idea of the Palestinians in general. At least on college campuses, the Palestinians are not the cause celeb that they used to be, partly because the Arab nations, Egypt, Jordan, the Gulf monarchies, they're really not worried too much about the Palestinians anymore. And they've come to the conclusion that Iran is such a greater threat to the Sunni Arab countries than are the Palestinians, that they sort of just shrug and say, you know what, it's time for you guys to grow up. You got a pretty good deal with Israel. Israel is not as bad as Iran. They're never going to nuke us in a preemptory attack. They're not sending Jewish terrorists in to kill us. They're not trying to assassinate our ambassador in Washington. That's Iran. And if you want to ally yourself with Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran, go ahead and do it. But you're not going to do it with our support, whether that be financial or political. That's new, as is this U.S. Petroleum independence from the region. And then I think most importantly, I just don't think that after all these decades that they resonate anymore. I know that when you talk to people, they'll say, wow, they're still refugees. You know, if Edward Said was around to shake his keys and say, these are the keys to my house in Jerusalem that was expropriated in 1946, some German's going to say, well, these are the keys to my house in Danzig, and now it's Gdansk. Or somebody who's a Volga German will say, these are my keys to my house in the Donuts Basin. So the world is full of refugees, but 70 years is sort of the time limit on victimhood. And I think that's the consensus. And the only place left for universal sympathy toward the Palestinians, there are places in Western Europe, and even that's fading, I think, as terrorism continues there.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.